In our tour of church history thus far, we've done what many such excursions do. We've concentrated our account on Europe. Appropriate lately, since we've been reviewing the Reformation, which was pretty much a European thing. But as we've seen in a sprinkling of previous episodes, the church, of course, existed in other places as well. We need to get caught up with those regions over the next few episodes. Now, in this one, we're going to take a look at what was happening with the church in Africa. Next, we'll take a look at what's happening with the church in the East. And a bit after that, we're going to see what's happening with what was then the New World. Now, North Africa was one of the formative cradles of Christianity. That's where three of the great Latin fathers of the faith had lived, Tertullian, Cyprian, and that towering intellect, Augustine. The church at Alexandria was one of the four main churches in the early centuries. Egypt was highly influential in defining what the faith looked like throughout much of Christendom because of men like Antony and Pachomius, known to history as the Desert Fathers. Their strict asceticism can be credited with forming the early picture of what popular, not necessarily biblical, holiness looked like, and which framed the thinking of Christians for then hundreds of years. Of course, it led in large part to the monasticism that had such a massive impact on how the church conducted itself for centuries. In this episode, we'll track the course of Christianity as it made its way across the African continent. Now, the genesis of Ethiopian Christianity rests in the book of Acts, chapter 8, where a deacon in Jerusalem, by the name of Philip, was used by God to lead an Ethiopian eunuch, that is a royal treasurer, to faith in Christ. Now, there's no record of what impact that man had when he returned home, but the fact that he'd made a special trip to Jerusalem in the first century, well, that reinforces the idea that there was already a Jewish-influenced community there in Ethiopia. Like so many of the Jews scattered around the world, meeting in local synagogues, these were prime candidates for the preaching of the gospel because Jesus was indeed the Jewish Messiah. The book of Acts shows us that it was among God-fearing Gentiles who attended the synagogues that the gospel found its most receptive audience. So it's likely when the Ethiopian eunuch returned home, he shared what he had discovered and a church was birthed. But not being nurtured by the waters of fellowship and apostolic leadership in Jerusalem, it went into decline. Before doing so, it may have left some seeds behind waiting for later watering. Now, the best records that we have attach the planting of the church in Ethiopia to a slave named Frumentius, right around the year 300 AD. Frumentius was on a trading voyage when he was captured by pirates and sold to the king of Aksum. He proved to be of such service to the king that he was granted his freedom after 40 years of faithful service. He immediately went to Athanasius, who was then the bishop of Alexandria, telling him of Ethiopia's need of missionary activity. Athanasius consecrated Frumentius as the bishop of Aksum, and thus began a long tradition in which Ethiopian Orthodoxy looked to Alexandria and later the Egyptian Coptic Church to appoint its leaders. This continued until as recently as 1959. Now, Frumentius's pioneering work was furthered by what are known as the Nine Saints from Syria, who arrived about 150 years after Frumentius. Their work saw the entire region of Ethiopia become a Christian kingdom. The government remained focused on a Christian monarch throughout several periods of upheaval over the centuries, right up until the time of Haile Selassie in the 20th century. Now, there are characteristics of Ethiopian Christianity that deserve our notice. It was an extremely Jewish form of Christian tradition, and for long periods observed a Saturday Sabbath rather than Sunday as their day of worship. It shared with the Falasha Jews of Ethiopia a great respect for the history of King Solomon and his visitor, you may remember, the Queen of Sheba. They had a tenacious legend that after Solomon's and the Queen's meeting in Jerusalem, as recounted in 1 Kings chapter 10 and 2 Chronicles 9, the Ark of the Covenant was removed from Jerusalem and taken to Ethiopia, where it was stored in secret. Now, various reasons are given for this. Most notably that as Solomon began his slide into apostasy, he, or one of the faithful priests, recognized that the day would come when foreigners would destroy the temple. So to preserve the ark, a duplicate was made, switched out with the real ark, which was then packed off for safekeeping to Ethiopia. Now, this led to the production of multitudes of these little miniature arks called tabot, and they were displayed all over places of Christian worship in all of Northeast Africa. The Ethiopian account of the royal meeting between Solomon and the Queen of Sheba is a document called the Kebra Nagast, which dates to the early 6th century. European Christians considered themselves Christian Jews. They retained the practices of circumcision right alongside baptism. Monarchs regarded their dynasty as from Solomon, and one of Haile Selassie's titles was Lion of Judah. Now, like the Ethiopian church that it's derived from, the Ethiopian church has a strong monastic tradition. The Nine Saints founded a number of communities around Aksum, places like Debra Damo, which lasted 1,000 years. Around 1270, Debra Labanos, a well-known monastery, became a center of renewal. Aksum had a large 5-aisled cathedral that was destroyed by Muslims in the 16th century. Now, at that point, the whole kingdom would have become permanently Muslim had it not been for Portuguese military assistance in a decisive battle in the mid-16th century. Much credit for the survival of the Ethiopian church. It goes to their ancient translation of the Bible into Ge'ez, a musical worship tradition practiced by the laity. Over the centuries, different Christian groups have rallied to their aid to assist them against oppressors. Despite their appreciation, the Ethiopian church has resisted attempts to align themselves with really any other group. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church has about 45 million members living in Ethiopia, about another 15 million internationally. Its 12th and 13th century rock-cut churches of the Lalibela region, they still delight tourists with their uniqueness of their architecture and the improbability of their construction. The survival of the church in Ethiopia underlines the tragic fate of the church next door in ancient Nubia. Today we know it as Sudan. Nubia possessed a flourishing Christian kingdom from the 8th to the 12th centuries. Centered at the capital of Khartoum, Nubian bishops, like their Ethiopian peers, were consecrated by the Patriarch of Alexandria. The church in Nubia began as a mission sent out by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian the Great and his wife Theodora in 543. By 580, the entire population were followers of Jesus. But by 1500, the entire region was Muslim, and what had been a flourishing church disappeared in the 1960s. Prior to the flooding of the northern Sudan for the Aswan Dam, excavations revealed the rich remains of the Nubian churches. Okay, see if you can remember back to your world history class, probably your freshman or sophomore year of high school. Can you remember what ethnic and national group sailed down the west coast of Africa looking for a way to the rich trading ports of the Indian Ocean? Very good if you remember that it was the Portuguese. In the 1480s, their progress down the west coast of Africa resulted in trading centers on the Gold Coast of Ghana and up the River Zaire. In 1491, missionaries evangelized the area and led the local king, his name was Mabanza Congo, to faith in Christ. He was baptized and renamed João, which is Portuguese for John, after the reigning Portuguese king. Now, following King Congo's conversion, the Christianization of that region continued under his successor, King Alfonso. He made Christianity the religion of the nobility, taking titles like Marquis from the Portuguese aristocracy. Alfonso's son, Henrique, was sent to Lisbon for education and was made a bishop in 1521. Unfortunately, he died not long after his return to Africa in 1530. Now, King Alfonso made regular appeals to the Portuguese for assistance in establishing the Christian faith from 1514 onwards. A Portuguese priest of that time left a vivid portrait of Alfonso, still regarded in the Congo as the Apostle of the Congo. He was a skillful preacher who established a tradition of royal preaching. And by all reports, this Congolese king was a genuine Billy Graham to his time and to his people. After his death in 1543, the story of the Congo is one of really missed opportunities. Though Alfonso made frequent appeals for missionaries to come and work in Africa, competition between Spain and Portugal, it stalled the efforts. And since the Jesuits were international, they arrived in the capital of Salvador and opened a seminary there in 1624. A Congolese ambassador visited Pope Paul V in 1608, an event commemorated in a Vatican fresco. The Capuchins, you may remember as a minor order of the Franciscans, they tried to carry on an outreach to the Congo, but conditions were brutal. Many of them died. By 1700, Christianity was fading from the region. It wasn't until Baptist missionaries arrived in the 19th century that things began to pick up once more. By the late 18th century, the slave trade from West Africa to the New World, it was running into the thousands. But after the successful campaign for abolition, led by William Wilberforce, with the help of a remarkable African in England, whose name was Aluda Aquiano, a British naval squadron patrolled the coast from 1807, searching for slavers. The Portuguese still exported thousands across the Atlantic to the slave fields of Brazil, as the English had done to the sugar plantations of the West Indies by the notorious Middle Passage. Sierra Leone became kind of a dumping ground for the British Navy's spoils from captured slavers. The Church Missionary Society, founded in 1799, they set to work providing relief and evangelism for these ex-slaves. By 1860, some 60,000 freed slaves were dropped off at what was called Freetown, but uprooted from their tribal structures and unable to return to their homes, they were gradually settled in what became model Christian villages. Among the arrivals in Sierra Leone was a group of 1,200 freed American slaves. They'd organized themselves into 15 ships at Nova Scotia and arrived singing hymns as they came ashore with their, Baptist, Methodist, and other pastors. Now, in time, Methodist life was greatly strengthened by the arrival from England of Thomas Freeman. He was the son of an African father and English mother. Being of African descent, Freeman was able to survive the West African climate, which had proved fatal for so many European missionaries. Freeman gave long service in West Africa. Eventually, some of the repatriated Africans of Sierra Leone caught the vision of returning to their own tribal people with the gospel. Among them was Samuel Crowther. Crowther had been liberated from a Portuguese slaver in 1821. He became one of the first students at the new missionary college at Fora Bay. He became a missionary to his branch of the Yoruba tribe in the 1830s, at the same time translating books of the New Testament into their language. Now, Crowther was part of a growing trend in mission, that of planting indigenous churches that were self-supporting, self-governing, and self-extending. Johannes Vanderkamp helped found the Netherlands Missionary Society. He was a retired soldier who became a doctor before arriving in Cape Town, South Africa in 1799. Now, his arrival among the Boers was, kind of like a match lit to a powder keg. The Boers were Dutch farmers of South Africa who tried to maintain their distance from the British and their constant conflict with native African tribes. Vanderkamp, he was brilliant. He upset the conservative-minded Boers with his marriage to a Malagasy slave girl, along with his virulent opposition to slavery and the oppression of Africans. He immediately went to work bringing the gospel to South African tribes and showed a special care for those displaced by armed conflict. Arriving in Cape Town from England at this time was Robert Moffat, whose style of mission work was very different from that of the indigenous designs of Crowther and his European friends. Moffat's philosophy of missions was more, old school. He built a mission compound which sought to preserve a little slice of England inside its fence. Africans then were invited to come into the compound and the missionaries for preaching and teaching of a gospel that was heavily flavored by a European brand of Christianity. Moffat gave 50 years to his mission that was just north of the Orange River. And this is where the famous Scottish missionary David Livingstone spent his first years after arriving in Africa. Livingstone married Moffat's daughter Mary, and Moffat guided Livingstone in his early years in the field. Now, Livingstone became a physician in Glasgow in 1841 and just arrived a year later in Cape Town. His and Mary's first child died in 1846. They lost another child 4 years later. So in 1852, Mary took their other children back to Scotland. That proved a bad move. She moved in with David's parents, her in-laws. And as you might expect, things did not go well, and so Mary began tipping the bottle in her loneliness. After Livingstone's epic journeys of 1853 through 1856 through the interior of Africa and his triumphant reception back home, they were reunited. Mary then accompanied him on his Zambezi expedition of 1858, but she died during that time. Livingston's eldest son, Robert, also died in 1864 as a soldier in the Union cause of the American Civil War. Though Scottish, Robert Livingston joined the Union Army to help in the cause of abolition, a value that he had learned from his courageous and monumentally giving father. As I'm sure you've heard, David Livingston was found by the explorer H.M. Stanley in 1871, and he died in 1873. His funeral, paid for by the British government, was held in Westminster Abbey on April 18th of 1874 with two royal carriages for the family, who included Moffat, two of Livingston's sons, and his daughter, to whom he'd been particularly close in his last years. Livingston spent his first 11 years at the Moffat mission station, but he felt the style of mission work there wasn't effective. He conceived his plan of exploration, which took him west to the Luanda coast of Angola and then east to the mouth of the Zambezi. You've likely heard the story, true it turns out, that the Africans came to love Livingston so intensely because they knew that he loved them so much that when he died, they consented to allow his body to return to his native Scotland, but they claimed his heart for Africa. While there were scattered attempts to take the gospel into East Africa throughout the centuries, nothing ever really took hold that we know of. It wasn't until Protestant missionaries of the 19th century arrived that any real consistent work began there. Then the church began to grow in Kenya and Uganda, but Protestants weren't the only ones bringing the gospel to East Africa at that time. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of Algiers, Charles Lavigery, he founded the Missionaries of Our Lady of Africa, known as the White Fathers. A group of them arrived in Uganda in 1878, and that brought a wave of conversions and an outbreak of violence between competing groups of Muslims, Catholics, and Anglicans. Infrequent but brutal atrocities moved the British to send in troops to quell the disturbances, and the region became a British protectorate in 1893. The colonial period that followed was a time of mass response to Christianity in the country.